so can you pick it up from there?
All right. Phase 3, I was back in camp in the bivouac area, and 9 o'clock the next day, we were summoned to get up back up on Hill 122, and D Company had a tank knocked out, and they wanted it towed in and repaired. It was repairable, I guess. And the area was right in the center part of Hill 122, and as we were approaching the area and leaving that road, where the hill begins at the base of the hill, we start drawing fire. And the paratrooper that was guarding the area says, "Why do you have to come around here?" And I says, "I got a tank to pick up and take back to repair. Every time you come around here with that damn thing, we draw, you get fire on. You got a radio? Are you in cahoots with the Germans?" And I said, "We don't use a radio. We don't communicate with nobody." So as we were moving along, I was trying to look to see where we're going, and the shells start coming in thicker and thicker. And we got halfway up the hill, and they were really coming in. I told Charlie to shut it off, but I heard one coming. And when you hear them coming, and then they stop coming, that's when you're going to be close. So I ducked. I turned my head. I had my body out of the turret looking with binoculars to pick out that D Company tank. And I put that binocular, I had them hanging on my neck. I dropped them and I put my fingers in my ears. And the shell exploded within inches of me on the outside of the tank. And when it exploded, the base of the shell ricocheted off of the turret and went through Shardy's back right shoulder and came out his lower left stomach. When I went to pick him up, my hand went into his cavity, and then I know for sure what that piece of the base of the shell that was laying in the bottom of the tank was the culprit that did the dirty work. And there was a lot of shrapnel flew around in the tank, and nobody got hurt. I'm amazed at Patsy Barchetta, the assistant driver. His head was right in line with the radio equipment, and that was demolished. How it missed him, I have no idea. But when Shorty got hit, he had it in double low gear, just itching along. And when it got hit, his body fell on the accelerator. All his weight was on the accelerator. And we went crawling up the hill, and I tried to, he got hit, he was going for a big pile of gas cans, and so I reached in there and I steered it back out in the middle of the road, and we were going around them cans, but then a paratrooper pulled me off, he was a sergeant, and he pulled me off the tank and taking me down in the foxhole right alongside. This was a very narrow road going up there, but there were some foxholes dug in them along the way, and he put me in one of them, and he laid on top of me. And I said, "Would you get off of me? I can't get no air." And as soon as he got off of me, I got up and ran, and I had tried to shut that damn tank off, and wouldn't stop running, because Shorty had his weight on the accelerator wide open in double low gear, and it just kept moving. Then I remembered to ground the magnetos, and as soon as I did that, the engine stopped, the tank stopped, and it was burning all around the turret on the outside, all the stuff we had on there. There was a bunch of souvenirs. It was all burning, and I threw them all off, and it was on fire inside, and I had pulled the fire extinguisher, put the engine part out, and also in the main chamber of the tank. But fires continued, and I took the fire extinguisher, and I put the fire out behind the instrument panel where the driver sits. It was burning in there. So I got all the fires out, and I helped get Charlie out of the tank, and all his belongings, and I loaded it up on the Jeep, and they'd taken him away. And then the colonel of the paratrooper says, it seemed like he was in charge of the operations right in that area. And now he says, "Who the hell can drive a tank? We got to get this damn tank out of here." And I said, "That's my tank, and I'll get it out of here." And I got in it, and I made a U-turn right in the middle of that road. And as I went back to, to our camp, to our bivouac area, the Germans followed me with at least four shells exploded alongside of me, but they were ready for me to pass that intersection where we had went the day before. We went to the right of that intersection, and there was that quarry where we where I had the experience with the potato masher. And if I would have went in there, I would have got blown to bits, but as soon as I got to that intersection, I made a left turn to go back to our camp. And when I did that, a great big shell hit alongside of me, and it made a hole in the road that I could bury my tank in. And it did a lot of damage to my ears at the time. It really walloped me a good one. And when I got back to camp, I come flying through there like a bat out of hell. I don't know how my men got back to camp even today yet. No one told me how. I didn't question them. But as the day progressed, evening was coming, and the doctor says, "Everybody, I'll have to take a shot. You're all a nervous wreck." So when it come to me, I said, "I'm not taking no shots. I want to be awake when them damn Germans come through here," because we were right alongside of a creek that was camouflaged, and you could see that they had been using that creek bed for a passageway. And I had a feeling we would have company that night, because the night before, it sounded like they were coming down the road when we were at that rock quarry. They had screaming meanies and burp guns and everything going that night, and it sounded like they were getting closer and closer. And I was ready for them. I had the old 50 aiming right at them if they ever got any closer. But as night approached back in the bivouac area, Ed Chileski got up out of the foxhole and went out in the middle of the open field there, near where two bodies was buried, and a burial crew came along that afternoon and removed those bodies. They had been there a few days. But Ed Chileski says, "Come on, you Germans, take me. You got my buddy Shorty. You might as well have me." So I went over and I grabbed him and I says, "You better get back in your foxhole and start praying, because that's what your mother's doing right now back in Pennsylvania. She's begging the Lord for you. Now it's time that you meet her in prayer. And start praying." So he passed out from the shop, and all was quiet until early the next morning, when these two rebels, Kenny Wallace and Whitehead, they were always in combat about religion. Both of them were always had heated discussions. So Whitehead got up real early that next morning, and he says, "I want everybody to hear me. I prayed last night. I really prayed." So that completes the story of Hill 122, except for when we left the area, when the planes came and bombed the area around St. Lowe. And then we moved out a couple of days later, and as we passed the Hill 122, that paratrooper group was at the far south end, and we had a stop, a layover. There was something holding up traffic up ahead, and I recognized that sergeant, and I says, "Hey there," and he says, "Oh, come over here. I got something to show you." So we ran around the corner, and here was this big tree with a bunch of 2x4s going up to the top of it, with 12, at least 12 or 15 wires. He was calling the shots for the artillery that met me every time I came there. He says, "This is why the Germans peppered the hell out of you. They had you in their view." And I was really glad to see why they picked on me. What was possible? Why didn't our tanks fire back? It was always a mystery to me.
So what was the explanation? What were the wires?
The wires
the German had an observation.
They had an observation up in the top of that tree, and he was calling the shots. He was telling the artillery, right or left, so many mils up or down, and that's why they followed me every day, and even the paratroopers was giving me hell. "Why do you have to come around here? You're drawing fire all the time." then for days, even weeks after that, I remember one night where we had work to do at night, and as we're driving along, all of a sudden there'd be a short in the instrument panel because it got highly damaged, and between Anger and I, we'd taken it all apart and repaired all the shorts and damages in there, and the radio system, we just disconnected that because we never used it, and we were getting hell. Shut that darn tank off because you're attracting attention with the splashes, hot sparks, because those tanks had that high voltage in there, and whenever there was a short in that instrument panel, it was like sending the Germans a message, and they thought I was in cahoots with them.
Now go back to Shorty when he was killed by the shell. Was that an armor-piercing shell or a high explosive?
It was a high explosive, yeah, because the whole base of the shell was still intact, about an inch thick, with jagged ends on it, and, 105, so, and I went in here, and that's when I grabbed him, and my hand went in there, and his clothes was all pulled in there, and he had a bowel movement, that happens when everybody gets hit.
And you grabbed him by the shoulder?
To lift him up out of the tank, first I rolled him off with an accelerator. He was laying on the accelerator, and I tried to stop the engine, and with him laying on that accelerator, I thought it would kill the engine, but it didn't until I ground the magnetos.
So what did you feel? I mean, you were so close to Shorty. What were you guys even
thinking? It was the limit of my endurance. I don't think I could take much more. It was hard to lose him because I'd been with him all the time, and we'd been so close. So it was hard to get a replacement. And when I got back to camp, nobody wanted to get back in that recovery unit. So Anger came to me, and he says, "Smokey, if you want me to drive your tank, I want it to be my tank. I want to be in charge of the tank, and I'll fix everything I can on it." We had a lot of rewiring, some of the wiring going back towards the engine, from the instrument panel. So he was pretty good at that, and I had a lot of previous experience with wiring. And so between the two of us, I agreed with him that, all right, if it'll be your tank, and you'll be responsible, but I'm still in charge. You'll have to take orders from me. And, oh, yes, he agreed. So, but in times, there was differences between him and Eugene Sand. And the company didn't want me to ride in the tank. They gave me a Jeep one time, and they wanted me to go for parts and go to ordnance and instead of dragging the tanks back to ordnance, let somebody else do it. And I was away from them for about 2 days, and everything was nothing but arguments. So I said to somebody, "Take this Jeep back to the company, and I'm going back in the tank." So then everything was peaceful. They were having an argument about adjusting a carburetor on a tank. They couldn't get it to run right, but that was one of my specialties, was the carburetor of the tanks. I learned that back in Fort Benning from that 10th Armored sergeant in charge. His name was Smith, a great big guy.
So that was adjusting the governor or the...
No, that was adjusting the air and fuel flow mixture. It has to be so much air and so much fuel. There's an adjustment screws on there for that, so you got to learn how to tune them in. It's like tuning an instrument.